In this weekend episode, three segments from this week's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN. First, Punchbowl News co-founder John Bresnahan discusses political reaction to a New York grand jury's voting to indict former President Donald Trump. Next, Chris Brown of the group Brady on this week's school shooting in Nashville and congressional reaction to calls for more gun legislation. Plus, Rebecca Rainey from the Independent Community Bankers of America on federal reaction to the SVB and Signature Bank crisis and what that means for smaller banks. Now, a discussion of the New York grand jury indicting former President Trump with Punchbowl News co-founder John Bresnahan.
Joining us this morning is John Bresnahan. He's the co-founder of Punchbowl News, a longtime reporter of Capitol Hill, to talk about congressional reaction. John Bresnahan, let's begin with the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. What was his reaction, and what do you think he does about it?
Well, McCarthy, like a lot of Republicans, expressed outrage over the news of the indictment, which broke last night. He said the House of Representatives will make sure, will continue to look into this issue. You've had chairs of three House committees, send a letter to Manhattan DEA Alvin Bragg asking him for testimony and documents. Actually, the deadline on that is today. But Bragg has indicated he's not going to cooperate. So you had McCarthy, who, of course, is a very close Trump ally. He's saying the House will, you know, look into this. We don't know whether the House will try to subpoena Bragg or what will happen if he misses the deadline. But, of course, that would be a whole different level of involvement in an ongoing criminal case. So we'll have to see how far House Republicans are willing to push this.
Yeah, Jim Jordan, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, tweeting out simply outrageous last night. You had the chair of the Oversight Committee, James Comer, tweeting out about this. The Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, has weaponized his office to launch a blatantly political indictment. So which committee will this fall under? Because you do have the new select subcommittee, the weaponization of the federal government, and then you have James Comer, who heads up the Oversight Committee.
Yeah, we'll have to see. And we'll have to see if they actually move ahead with any kind of subpoena. Now, again, they threatened a subpoena or intimated there would be a subpoena. But that was before the news that Trump has been indicted. Interfering, a congressional committee interfering with an ongoing, an active criminal case is a really It's really kind of an unprecedented move. We've seen it before. We haven't seen it in decades. And congressional committees usually stay out of this. And in this case, you would think that Bragg would resist any kind of subpoena or any move to subpoena anything related to the case. And this will end up in court. But to cross the line for the Judiciary Committee or the Oversight Committee or the House Administration Committee, which is also involved, that would be a pretty serious step. It sounds like, you know, Republicans may do it, but again, this would be a serious step. Just as, you know, Bragg seeking indictment of Trump is unprecedented, having something like this happen would be really, you know, having congressional committees try to subpoena a DA in the middle of a criminal case. That would be really a move that I haven't seen anything like that in my time. And I've been reporting for 30 years on the Hill.
So we talked about the Republicans in the House. They have the majority there. They are the minority in the Senate. What has been the reaction from Senate leaders over there? Have we heard from Minority Leader Mitch McConnell?
We have not. And Minority Whip John Thune, they haven't said anything. We did report this morning in Punchbowl News. There was a statement from the number three Senate Republican, John Barrasso. He was outraged over this. You had a number of other senators, Republican senators, expressing out their displeasure. Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina, he put out a very strong statement in defense of Trump and how, you know, criticizing Bragg and saying how dangerous this is. You saw a number of other senators say the same thing, that the Bragg is going by through this indictment, pursuing this case that the Justice Department did not pursue. That Bragg is going to a place that prosecutors shouldn't go, that it's become a political prosecution, an attempt to destroy a candidate for president, a former president who's a candidate for president now. So again, this is you know, the whole, you know, we're off the map here. We're not in a, you know, there's no, we're in a place where this hasn't occurred before.
What about Democrats, their reaction?
Democrats are pretty cautious. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer put out a statement. Former Speaker Nancy Pelosi's put out a statement, a number of Democrats pretty much saying the same thing, that Trump is innocent in, you know, or this is just an accusation. Trump has the right to full defense, you know, get a good criminal, legal defense. But they're saying again and again, you hear this, every Democrat is saying nobody's above the law, even former presidents. So you heard that, you know, I probably heard that 25 times within the last day from Democrats saying, you know, no one is above the law. That's what they're saying, that, you know, that Bragg had the right to bring charges against Trump for this crime, and that no one, and if he violated the law just because of Trump's status as a former president, doesn't make him immune from any kind of criminal action.
We've seen security being beefed up in cities, including the Capitol. The timing of this, though, occurred hours after the House had adjourned and the Senate was gone, and now they're on a break for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, they're not, Congress not back till April 17th, which is, you know, literally this broke literally, you know, a couple hours after they had, you know, they'd wrapped up for this period of in session, and they're gone until the middle of April for the Easter recess, a spring recess. And, you know, it was unbelievable, because all week that's all anybody was talking about was, will Trump be indicted? Will Trump be indicted? And then there were confusing reports that, you know, the grand jury wasn't going to do anything until, you know, later in April. And I believe the reports that Trump himself was surprised, and his legal team. So, you know, everybody kind of, you know, took it on the Hill, kind of took a deep breath and said, okay, well, they'll come back and we'll end up dealing with this. And then, you know, literally we were sending out our PM edition and this story broke, and the New York Times broke the story about the indictment. So it caught everybody, not the fact that he was indicted so much as the timing of it. It caught everybody flat-footed. It, you know, it was really a shocking move. And I do think, you know, members are scattering all over the place. There were congressional delegations going overseas and otherwise, so I think this kind of just surprised everybody, and they still, I think we'll have a lot more discussion about it today.
That was John Bresnahan of Punchbowl News. Next, Chris Brown from the group Brady joins the program to talk about the deadly school shooting in Nashville and how Congress should react to it.
Back with us now is Chris Brown, president of Brady, formerly the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Chris Brown, your statement this week after the shooting in Nashville: we don't have to live like this. Explain.
Gun violence in America today is now the number one killer of our children. There are parents who are afraid to send their kids to school, and kids who are afraid to go to school. This is a uniquely American epidemic. Folks who live in other countries, industrialized countries, look at America as a war zone. And I don't think we can call ourselves the land of the free and home of the brave when we're basically conscripting our children to live this way, and politicians don't have the character or bravery to make a difference on this, because stronger gun laws save lives. And guess what? The vast majority of Americans want them enacted. So when I say we don't have to live this way, I mean that. There are people beholden to the gun industry who are standing in the way of protecting our kids. So we need to make this an issue that's top priority to fix. And we can fix this with stronger laws.
Obviously, the investigation at the Covenant School there in Nashville is still ongoing. What details, though, have you learned so far that stand out to you?
Well, the interview of the parents who said that they tried to remove guns from their daughter, who had been struggling with some mental health issues, and thought that they had removed all of them. That comes to mind because they live in a state, Tennessee, that has not actually enacted a whole host of gun laws that potentially could have helped here. One of them is an extreme risk protection law. 19 states in the District of Columbia have those laws, and they enable family members in some states, law enforcement in all states, to remove guns from an individual who is at risk to themselves and others. So states like Tennessee are depriving their citizenry of key tools that can be used to stop this kind of carnage. And I find that deeply, deeply troubling.
Extreme risk protection laws, that's also known as a red flag law?
Yes, also known as a red flag law. And let's just consider statements like representatives that I heard yesterday on the Republican side of the ledger saying, oh, there's nothing we can do. Yet they're coming from states that are interested in banning books, but not assault weapons being used to kill our children. It shouldn't be that our children in America have to be braver than our politicians to survive. It's just not right.
What's a stabilizing brace?
Stabilizing brace is a tool that can be added to certain kinds of firearms. They were designed for individuals who had certain kinds of handicaps in terms of their grip of the gun. And the stabilizing brace that the reason we're talking about this is it is asserted, although I don't have final information, that the shooter used a stabilizing brace, and it's an apparatus that is more highly regulated. And Congress was supposed to be having a hearing to determine whether to change a regulation, to rescind a regulation around stabilizing braces, but that got canceled after the shooting.
What legislative path forward do you see for any of the issues that we've brought up already, whether it's red flag laws or stabilizing braces?
Well, I think on the stabilizing brace issue, we need stronger regulation, not weaker regulation. We have that. So I encourage Congress not to rescind that rule. It took a long time to put that rule together, and that's not the direction that we should go. I feel good about extreme risk laws. I feel even better because the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act that passed last year, signed into law by President Biden, provides significant funding to states to incent them, like Tennessee, to pass their own versions of extreme risk protection laws. And for states that have them in effect, funding to train and implement them, because laws are only as good as the knowledge of those laws. I want an assault weapons ban passed. I want regulation of high capacity magazines. I want the Brady Law to be expanded. I'm not sure that this House of Representatives is prepared to do that, but I know the people of America want that to happen. And those are just some of the solutions that do need to be put forward. I'm proud of this president for the number of executive actions he's taken with the inaction of Congress. But as he said, there's only so much left that he can do. Congress has to act.
That was Chris Brown from Brady. Finally, a discussion on recent moves by the federal government to protect banks with Rebecca Rainey from Independent Community Bankers of America. She gave her perspective on how smaller banks were viewing this.
So, Rebecca, tell us what the Independent Community Bankers of America is and who do you work with?
Thank you. So the Independent Community Bankers is a national trade association that represents all community banks across this country. And we work with our members, community bankers across the country, representing communities of rural, suburban, and metro areas.
And what is a community bank? How do you define that?
So a community bank is a local institution whose business model is based on relationship banking. Essentially, what a community bank does is take local deposits, turns that around in the form of loans to create essentially economic development in communities across the U.S.
And why are they important? I mean, you've got a lot of big banks. They've got a lot of resources and economies of scale. So why even have community banks?
Absolutely. So for community banks, if it weren't for a community bank, one in three counties in the United States would not have a local financial institution. Community banks make over 60% of all small business loans under a million in this country, and they make 80% of all agriculture loans. So basically what you're looking at there is an infrastructure that's built this nation's economy. When we think about the role of small businesses, their access to credit is through a local institution. Community banks are able to offer the high-touch technology and all those products and services, but at the end of the day, when you have a problem, you have a question, you have a local banker that's there to help you in the good times and, more importantly, in the challenging times.
Let's talk about the bank failures, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. What happened from your perspective?
So it's a great question. What, you know, as we begin to study and understand what's happened here in this institution, which nearly tripled in size between 2019 and 2022, they had a very concentrated business model, depositors and loans to a very volatile industry of high tech and venture capital. As many have said lately, was not a well-managed institution, and so they were taking on incredible risks without a framework to really appropriately manage that in a very high-growth environment.
And did those failures really impact community banks and smaller banks?
So what we saw in the failure, one, it happened so quickly. Essentially, what we saw was a digital run on the bank where billions of dollars were withdrawn from the bank in less than 24 hours. And it really caused people to question what has happened here as depositors. Are my money safe? And as we went through the weekend trying to understand what had happened and why this institution failed so quickly, essentially, it's made folks wonder, what does that mean to other institutions? And so it's been a great opportunity for us to really say what happened there and in those two institutions were very different from what you see in community banks.
There's a headline here from Reuters that says small U.S. banks see record drop in deposits after SVP collapse. So what does that mean? Are people starting to pull their money out of the smaller banks, going to the larger banks?
So first, what I have to do is distinguish small banks, and there's a lot that's thrown into this category. SVB at once was called the small bank, and they were $210 billion, the 16th largest bank in the country. To me, that's not a small bank. So what we have seen is that for the nation's community banks, really the smallest, the local institutions, their deposits have remained steady over this time. And in fact, we're hearing in some of them, their deposits are growing because, again, getting back to that business model, it's a relationship that folks have with the local community banker that they know, that they trust, and feel like that's a safe source for them and their deposits these days.
And do you agree that the federal government should have stepped in on those two bank failures? You know, people are calling it a bailout. The administration keeps saying it's not a bailout. Where do you stand on that?
What a tricky call to make. We needed a sense of calm in this country, and that is essentially what happened. I think the question here is, as we think about this concept of bailout, are we rewarding risky decisions and actions? And there will be a lot that we'll need to unpack as part of that as we think about decisions that are made in the future. But I do completely agree that we needed calm to prevail, folks to take a deep breath and be able to assess what is needed as we work through those two failures.
You know, some said that it was the regulators that were asleep at the wheel. What do you think of that? Is there more regulation that's needed? What do you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. When I look at the level of growth, when I look at the concentration that had taken on, the decisions and maybe lack of tools in terms of managing their interest rate risk, there's no community bank that would have been allowed to operate for years at a time in that sort of scenario. And so whether they were asleep at the wheel, not applying applicable or similar rules or laws, I can tell you that wouldn't have happened in a community bank. And so for us, that raises a lot of questions.
Well, Senator Elizabeth Warren blames the rollback of the 2018 law, rolling back Dodd-Frank, essentially. Do you agree with that? Did your organization support that 2018 law?
So we did support what was called 2155, the bill that that made some of these changes that the senator has referenced. I don't think we know enough yet to know that that was the cause of failure. Again, I go back to why weren't we enforcing the rules that as community banks we know to be in existence. And that clearly was not the case in terms of what this bank was allowed to do and the decisions that were made there.
That was Rebecca Rainey, President and CEO of Independent Community Bankers of America. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.